Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard.
Hi, everybody. This is Matt Gourley. And more importantly, this is I Was There Too, the show where I talk to people present in the great scenes of cinema history. And even more importantly, this is the 46th episode of this podcast, which means we're getting close to episode 50, which means I've been putting my feelers out for some of my favorite ideas for movies to talk about for this show, all culminating in something I hope might be kind of special for episode 50, even if that doesn't necessarily mean a guest. What does that mean? You're going to have to stay tuned to find out. But today, Putter Smith from one of my all-time favorite James Bond movies, Diamonds Are Forever. It's a campy, delicious treat. It's like a big bowl of ambrosia. Putter doesn't normally do interviews. In fact, I reached out to him long ago after reading that he lived in South Pasadena. I live in Pasadena, and I thought, hey, maybe I'll just drop this guy a line, jaunt on over there, we'll be fast friends. But I never heard back, and I can't blame him. But it just so happens, out of pure coincidence, my old college friend, Rachel Mays, is his goddaughter. She, I guess, maybe listened to the podcast or saw that I posted about it or something and got in contact with me, and I'm glad she did because she's, made a small dream come true. In fact, it was a really fun interview. I went over to his house, just like I mentioned, in South Pasadena, and we sat out on his back veranda and the birds were chirping and the trash trucks were blaring, but it was a relaxed atmosphere, and we dig in and take our time, and he tells me all about his career as a jazz musician and session musician on a lot of great songs, like You've Lost That Love and Feeling, and tells me a little bit about working with Thelonious Monk and even Phil Spector. It was a great interview. He played Mr. Kid, one half of the famous duo, and Lover 2, the other ruthless killer in this duo, Mr. Wint, in this film. He wasn't an actor before he had done this, and didn't do a ton of acting after, so it was a unique experience worth hearing about. We're going to go ahead and get started, but before we do that, I want to say that you should definitely get tickets for the Now Hear This Podcast Festival, October 28th through 30th. On the 29th, I will be doing a live version of this show, and my guest will be none other than Marc Maron. We'll be talking about his famous fight scene role in Almost Famous. We'll be talking about his show, Maron, and probably if either of us have it our way, we'll just talk about our cats. I really think it's going to be a blast. I'm really very excited to have Mark as a guest. And also, my other show, Super Ego, will be there. I will be a guest on another podcast or two. You can buy one-day tickets. You can buy full three-day tickets. You can buy it all, and it's going to be worth doing. Go to nowhearthisfest.com to find out more. All right, enough business. Let's get into the podcast interview, and then we'll take a break later for more business.
The film, Diamonds Are Forever. The year, 1971. The role, Mr. Kid. The actor, Putter Smith.
Well, Putter Smith, you are primarily a jazz musician. You've played with the likes of Thelonious Monk, Art Blakey, Marlene Dietrich, and Burt Bacharach. How did it come to pass that you ended up acting as one of the two lethal hitman lovers in Diamonds Are Forever?
Well, it was freaky. I was working at Shelley's Manhole, which at that time I was working at quite a bit.
Where's that?
It was in Los Angeles on Cahuenga. It's no longer there. It was owned by Shelley Mann, and who was a great benefactor and a great musician. And the director came in. I was working with Thelonious Monk,
wow,
which was pretty much the high point of my life. And the director came in, and I believe at one point on a break he asked me something, the director, but I don't know if I'm creating a phantom memory.
This is Guy Hamilton, the director Diamonds Are Forever.
I didn't know him. I didn't know a name. I wasn't into film at all, except I was a civilian fan. You know, like I loved the Bond movies and stuff like that, but I wasn't into directors or anything like that.
Did he introduce himself as someone who was directing the next Bond? He didn't give you no clue.
Nothing at all. Just a person. And I don't even know if I'm making that up. You know what I mean? It might be a phantom memory.
Yeah,
but I just have a picture of him standing there in the back room, back end of Shelley's Manhole. And anyway, so about 3 months later, I get a phone call asking if I was the bass player with Thelonious. And I said, yeah. And they said, can you come to Universal tomorrow? And sure. You know, I'd done all, as a musician, you do all sorts of odd things. And I thought maybe they needed a bass track or they needed a sideline bass, something, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I asked, should I bring my bass? And they said, no. And so I went down and, here's this office, you know, and here's these guys and Guy Hamilton sitting there and they hand me a script and I can't believe it. I never have acted in my life and never had a desire to. And my wife was an actress at the time and going out and doing auditions and such like that. And so I would help her read scripts, you know, and so I knew how to read a script, but so they said, read this part. And so I read it and they laughed and they said, well, there will be a screen test. I said, well, I can't believe this. You know, I mean, this is like, I was laughing. This is hilarious. You know, James Bond movie. And so they called me and I did a screen test with Paul Williams.
Yeah, I read that.
And I knew Paul already. And Paul, what do we do? You know, and he said, just, he told me how it went, that there's, I can't recall now, but I think something like a bell rings and then like a school bell. And then somebody says speed and then that's it. It isn't lights, camera, action.
I mean, you're looking for him to guide you through literally the basics of how a screen test goes.
I didn't even know what to do at
all.
You know? And what they said was they had us on a stage and they said, step out from the curtain and laugh. You know, uh-huh. I mean, that was, and so I'm, we step out and, Paul, who's, you know, good actor and a really great guy, he's laughing his ass off, you know, and I'm standing there, like moving my mouth and my head up and down as if I'm laughing, not making a sound.
Oh. Why is that? Do you think you just?
I just didn't have anything. I didn't know how to make a laugh, you know. And I'm nervous, and so anyway, that was that. And the next thing you know, and then I believe Paul Williams couldn't agree on a price, and so they got this guy Bruce Glover.
Yeah.
And so that was we're off and running, and I didn't even know the character was gay, and so. The night before they sent a script over, you know, the night before we left to shoot the first scene in Vegas, get on the plane, shoot the first scene. So I'm pretty like, wait a minute, these guys are gay, you know? And
what was it? Was it the stage direction where they take each other's hand that clued you in on that?
Yeah. And later on, I say she looks good for a girl. And,
yeah.
But, now, you know, people will say, you know, I have Jewish friends, you know, or whatever, you know. But, you know, I did have, you know, dear gay friends, you know, and I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm not a, any kind of a homophobe, but I don't want, I didn't, I was kind of bent out of shape that I, they thought I looked like one, you know. Of course, now, you know, we're just watching a show on Barney Frank. So what does one look like? But that turned me around for a minute. And then I was, while I was in Vegas doing the scene, there was a thing in Time magazine about Rex Harrison and Richard Burton doing a movie where there are a couple of gay hairdressers. And I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it. You know? And, but it does affect people. You know, people I knew, it was a little strange, but I never had any problems about that. But.
Did you and Bruce Glover discuss that in terms of your character's relationship and how that would affect the
portrayal?
No,
we never discussed anything like that.
Really? Even in the tone of the character? Because it's an eerie and interesting tone. You just went straight for it, huh?
No, my wife said, she says, you know, just be yourself. Just be yourself, you know, like do that stuff as if it's you doing it and not try to act like a big queer, you know.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
Just be yourself. And so that's what I did, you know. And she would, when they would send the sides out, you know, she would work with me the night before and go through the scene until it was natural, you know. And that's, I mean, as far as my performance in the film, since that time, I've become a real movie fan, not to the extent of one of those critics, you know, where I see every movie made, but I pay attention to all the credits, the writers and the directors, and pick up on actors and look them up on IMDb when I see a actor that impresses me, you know, and gained a tremendous respect for the real great actors, the ones that can really take you somewhere.
Yeah.
You know? And so a couple of years ago, I watched my movie again and I thought, oh my God, you brought nothing. You brought nothing, you know, nothing, you know, like just standing there, just, you know, like
a, but if I may speak for you, the minimalist performance that you give is one of those ones where the viewer is able to apply what they want to that, and in its own way is very effective.
True, know? True.
Whether that was intentional or not, I don't know, but it works.
No, I had no technique or no anything. All I had was myself.
It's interesting that you're paired up with Bruce Glover, who I don't know him, I've never met him, but from interviews I take him to be someone who really digs into that stuff and is very serious and a bit peculiar. And I just wonder...
Yeah, he's a real actor, you know, and I mean, that's what he does. And you know, but he left me alone, and, you know, we kind of... I had some real nice, I don't remember his name, but the guy that played the dentist in the very beginning of the movie.
The one you kill?
Yeah, the night we got there. We didn't start shooting the day we got there. It was the next day. And I met him the night before, and he was a really wonderful guy. And he pulled some stuff out of his wallet, you know, like Words to Live By kind of stuff. And it was beautiful, you know. I don't remember what they were, but the one thing Guy Hamilton said to me, I said, you know, I've never acted. I don't know, you know, I have no idea what to do. He says, but you know how to perform.
Yeah.
You know how to be. In other words, you know how to be yourself. So, I guess that was his confidence, and so he never told me what to do except to. When I was standing under the helicopter, I was hunched over. Yeah. You know, Jeeveny, they're really close. Those blades are about 20 feet in the air, you know. But I said, stand up straight. You know, I was afraid to.
Well, you have quite a tall posture, and it's interesting that they would have chosen Paul Williams initially, that they were clearly going for some odd couple contrast.
I guess so, and maybe that's what didn't work out. But I never asked Paul about it, but... it was kind of indicated to me that it was about money.
That's what I had heard too, yeah. It's funny, did you ever see Smokey and the Bandit? Because he ends up in a pairing with Pat McCormick, who's very tall.
No.
And it's almost like that was what this would have been.
Yeah. Well,
in matching suits and that sort of thing. Yeah.
I would really have loved to have been hanging with him. He was a really, really nice person, good person.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
I read once that Bruce Glover said that he had fooled Sean Connery into making him believe that you guys were actually lovers, and that once Connery saw Bruce Glover on a flight flirting with a girl later on and came up to him and said something like, you bastard, you son of a bitch. He thought you guys were gay all along. I don't know if that's an apocryphal story or...
I haven't got the slightest idea.
How was it working with Connery?
How is Sean?
Yeah.
He's even better than you would hope.
Really?
He's like, not only is that who he is, he's even better. He doesn't shoot you on sight, you know. But, I mean, he's a kind guy, very kind, but a real man. I mean, I hate to say words like that, but, you know, a mensch.
Yeah.
You know, and... everybody, the crew and everybody, just crazy about him.
Really?
And me too. And he played a little drums. He had a drum set brought on the set one time. He was playing a little drums. He was mad.
Did you play with him?
No, I didn't. I didn't have my bass. I bought a bass in London that I played for the next 25 years, but I didn't have it with me. Too bad.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known.
What if you guys would have started up a duet?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got to get a band. Get a band together. Get some
it's
of the great
late.
English musicians.
Yeah. Now, this was the last of his Bond films before he did one in the 80s, but he was known to be quite weary of the franchise at this time. Did you ever get any sense of that?
Never.
No.
No.
Consummate professional.
No, he's really great.
Wow.
Really great on set. He would, since this people would be listening to this, you know, he's putting on an English accent. You know,
right,
he has a thick Scottish accent, like guttural. You know, sounds like a goat. You know, and I mean, he was raised in rural Scotland. You know, a farm, so he would. You know, my real name is Patrick, and so they had my name as Patrick. You know, he would say to me every time I was on set with him, which I don't know, was a dozen times, he'd say, "Hiya, Pat. How are they treating you? Are they treating you okay?" Only it was,
"Hey, Paul, hey, they're treating you. They're treating you okay."
You know, and I mean, it was like, wonderful, wonderful. This is Sean Connery.
It's funny, you know, watching the film yesterday through for your scenes, you end up carrying Sean Connery multiple times. A lot of your scenes are just hauling, you and Bruce Glover hauling an unconscious Sean Connery.
He's quite heavy.
I can imagine, yeah.
Lifting him out of the trunk of the car, and I was like, wow, man, I'm lifting Sean Connery.
Yeah, I know. It must have been something, huh?
Yeah.
So you say your name's Patrick. How did you get the name Putter?
Oh, I was called Putt-Putt as a child, which was a little motor scooter. Something called a doodle bug also, and it had a little two-cylinder or whatever they call those things, two-stroke.
Yeah, two-stroke engine.
He goes, put, 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 put. And I've always been overweight. And people said I look like, when we're playing baseball and I run the bases, I look like a putt-putt. You know, so I was called Putt-Putt until I was 11. And then my buddy Jim Sullivan started calling me Putter. And it's been Putter ever since.
And that stuck, yeah. When you originally kill the dentist in that film, Bruce Glover drops a scorpion down the back of his jacket, but you guys also shot a scene where you drop it in his mouth.
Yeah.
Did they have the foresight at the time to shoot it both ways, thinking it might be too grotesque?
They shot it both ways. They thought it was too hideous the other way.
Well, speaking of hideous, I want to talk about your death scene where you get roasted to death while holding two.
Speaking of hideous, I want to speak about your acting in general. Yeah.
I wasn't going to go that far. I'm in Team Putter for this film. I love it. You know, for my 40th birthday, my fiance threw me a surprise party, and everybody came dressed as Bond characters, and my sister-in-law dressed up as you.
Oh,
do you want to see a picture?
Out.
This is in the end.
You must be a rare beauty.
She's incredibly creative.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that incredible?
That is incredible. Oh, my God.
I'll put that photo on the website.
Please send it to me, okay?
Oh, I will. I sure will.
And do you have a picture of her in normal?
Yeah, yeah.
And could you send me one of that?
Of course, yeah.
Along with it? Yeah.
Yeah. And this is my friend Rob Schraub and Kate Freund that went as the duo as well.
And who's he?
He's you as Mr. Kidd and she's Mr. Wint?
Well, one star.
Well, I'll send you a picture of Sarah.
Yeah, send me all that stuff, please. I'll use it on my album cover.
So, what was it like? I watched the film, and I see your arms go up in flames, and I'm thinking, that has to be great makeup on a stuntman. But then when I watched the documentary, that's actually you getting your arms burnt, right?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, I had complete faith in Guy Hamilton, and Jill St. John was on the side there, and we had been very friendly, and she was a terrific person, and there are ladies that are kind of like natural musician type chicks, you know, that gravitate towards musicians, and she's like that, and not that you know, I tell Robert Wagner not to worry, he's not in any trouble. But, you know, she's just sort of a relaxed and understanding what's happening. And so she's off on the side, and she says, is he getting hazard pay for this? And they were like, everybody was looking at her like, shut the fuck up. You know? he should be getting hazard pay for this, you know. But my thought was, hey, you know, this is such an unbelievable thing. I'm just happy.
They didn't give you hazard pay for that?
No. I mean, I didn't. What for? Why? What? You know?
Well, because your arms were both on fire.
Well, yeah, that was on fire. And
it's so close to your hair, too. That's the thing that scared me to death.
Well, the scene was they wrapped my arms in asbestos cloth.
Well, there's
that
hazard pay,
that
right?
I probably should have got hazard pay.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then they put that white thing on them, the white jacket, and then they put airplane glue on that, and they have it wired to a battery. And before they did this, they said, when we call cut, step back and put your arms straight out. Don't put them up over your head. Just put your arms straight out. And they did a test run with two guys with the fire extinguishers, you know, and they did a complete test thing, you know, so... So then they do that when Sean Connery throws the brandy on me, and they click it and it ignites, you know, and I freak out, you know, everything. And then they yell cut, and I step back, and they put me out. Then they bring in the stuntman, and he's much smaller than I, and he. They had made a life mask, and a latex life mask, and they had copper foil over the eyes, and they had made a wig, my hair, and so they had him dressed up, and they also had these large asbestos fake hands, which I wore, and so. They put all that on him, and the second burning, then they totally engulf him. So if you see the scene, you'll see that I catch fire back up, and then there's a headshot of Jill St. John, and then they shoot back to me. It's the stuntman, completely engulfed, and he runs off, jumps over the side onto a pile of cardboard boxes. But the hands had become stiff from the first burning, and they broke when he hit the ground, and he was... pretty seriously burned on his wrists.
No kidding.
But I think he was getting hazard pay.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, I hope he's fine.
Would you imagine you were more nervous to do the fire hands or just your first take out there in the desert where you have to do acting for the first time?
You know, I was never nervous like that because my wife had said, just be yourself. Remember, they called you. You didn't present yourself as an actor.
That's a good point. Yeah, the blame's on them.
So I just, you know... this is it, guys. You know, I haven't got any more, you know. And Guy Hamilton was correct because of my, you know, I had been playing with musicians, performing all my life in all sorts of situations, you know, Boston Symphony Hall and dumps everywhere, you know. And it's all the same if you're a performer. You're always performing at the highest level that you can. And, to do that, you have to be comfortable in your own skin. And so I was able to do that. I was able to be just myself. But I had nothing to draw on technically, you know, like how to conjure up tears or anything like that. Or, I mean, you see these great actors, you know, Javier Bardem, where he's a completely, utterly, totally different character in 5 different movies.
Both of you Bond villains.
You're
in an elite club.
Yeah, you know, that's right. He's my colleague. I've never thought of that till this minute.
That's right.
Yeah, I'll have to let him know.
You, Christoph Waltz, I mean, you're in some great company.
Well, I was so ignorant. I didn't even realize the depth of the actors that I was in the movie with.
Right.
I mean, it's through the years when I watch these old English movies and I go, my God, you know, and I didn't. And the other day I was watching, was it The Lavender Hill Mob or one of those old Alec Guinness classics, you know, and they're the assistant director, who is really the guy that's running the show, is Guy Hamilton.
Guy Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah, and I go, wow, you know. All that sort of, and speaking of assistant director, you know, the guy, he was great, the guy on the Bond film. But Guy Hamilton took me over to, Alfred Hitchcock was making a film on one of the other stages and introduced me to him. And,
really? What was that like?
Great. Fabulous. You know, I mean, he's, you know, we didn't have a conversation or anything, just met and shook hands.
Wow.
He looked me up and down, you know.
Really?
And, I've had several thoughts since then, you know, and that I've seen some old Hitchcock movies, and one where he's playing bass in you know how he's always in the scene somewhere,
and he
was playing bass in a pit band, and it was about my age at that time and kind of looked like me, and I thought maybe this was Guy Hamilton's joke to play on. Maybe that's why he cast me, because I reminded him of what Alfred Hitchcock looked at, that this was his moment, you know. But you know how you create these scenarios that have no connection to reality, but that would be a nice one.
That seems like Guy Hamilton's type of sense of humor. He seemed
He
was in that kind of thing, yeah. There's a whole thing in Diamonds Are Forever where Sean Connery uses an alias of Klaus Hergesheimer, and it's solely because Guy Hamilton would use that term for anything, a doohickey that he couldn't remember the name of. So he goes, oh, just put the Hergesheimer there, and that sort of thing. So they threw it in the film.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was your first film, and then you went on to do a little bit more acting work. What?
It's like, for the first year afterwards, I kind of like, well, maybe something will happen, you know, but you really have to go after acting, you know, and nothing happened. Then about 10 years later, a friend of one of my wife's acting friends, a friend of his was becoming an agent, was looking for clients, and he mentioned me to him, and he called me and said, I can get you some work. I said, great, why not, you know? And so he was sending me out on things, and I was getting about every fourth one, and I...
Wow, that's a pretty good rate.
What they said was really, really kind of amazing, you know. In the meantime, since between the time, so listen here, actors, I'm going to tell you how to do it. I had, there was a look here in South Pasadena, cable. They needed people to make material from local to somehow, and so please make some films. And so I got into it with a group of 6 or 7 people, and we were producing films, and mostly musicians, which I still have these really great little half-hour films. So we decided to do a TV show, like a show, a comedy show, and had an idea for it. And it went so far as to cast, put an ad in Dramalog and Variety, one or the other, or both, I can't remember, casting. And so here I was in... It was functioning as a casting director, you know, and I'm sitting there, and the people are coming in, and you realize you're not sitting there looking and trying to find something wrong. You're trying to find something right. You're hoping that the next person is it. And generally speaking, when they come through the door, you know if they're it or not. You know, it's somebody like Dustin Hoffman or Meryl Streep can jockey for a part that nobody thinks they can do and get it, you know, because they have the power. But a regular working actor, they have no... It's you're either right for the part in their minds or not.
Well, that goes back to Guy Hamilton back at the club. He saw something in you, and he just went, "Why mess around?" I'm sure.
Well, he had the idea, and so anyway, armed with that knowledge, when I would go out on an audition, I was not the slightest bit concerned. In the first place, this wasn't my thing. In the second place, I knew that I was right in their mind or not, and that there was nothing I could do about it.
Yeah, that's liberating.
There was nothing I could do. Yeah, it's liberating because you really do not care.
And it frees you up to do a better job when you're not worried
about
it.
Well, I guess, yeah. You know, so I was getting these parts, you know, and I would get mad, you know, feeling when you feel like you're being abused, like there'd be casting call, you get there and there'd be 300 people. You go, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Then another time I got called for a Rocktoberfest, and they wanted an old guy. And they said, "Do you have a pair of lederhosen?" "Oh yeah, sure. I've got like four. What kind? What color would you like me?" "Of course I don't." You know
what's sad is I do. I do have a pair of lederhosen.
They say, "Well, show up. They may have a pair for you." Jesus, you know. So it was so inconvenient.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, my at that time of my life, my days were mapped out from beginning to end.
This
is
exactly how I feel about it. And you have to drive across town, and it just ruins your whole day.
Yeah, it ruins the whole day. You know? I've got my 4 hours of teaching in the morning. I have a rehearsal in the early afternoon, and then I have, then I go home and I take a nap and then go to my gig, you know. I mean, because I take naps every day. So they call, you need to be at, you probably know the place, it's near Laurel Canyon in Ventura. It's some studio.
Was it CBS Radford?
Yeah. Okay, be there at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock. Oh. Perfect.
And where are you living at the time?
Here
in the East. Yeah. Yeah. Oh God, I feel it.
We've been in South Pass for 45 years.
Ugh.
And so I go, you know, and I'm pissed because I'm tired, you know, and it's my nap time, and I open the door, and there's 10 guys that look just like me, all wearing lederhosen.
Oh, Jesus. Well, now I want to talk about the real I was there, too, the work you've done. As a musician, worked with Thelonious Monk. Was that primarily touring or also as a session musician?
It was just live. Session musician is something, a total other world, you know. Thelonious, true jazz giant, and he had coming back from a tour of Asia, and Bill Cosby had paid for this for his bass player and his tenor player to go to the Manhattan School of Acting. He was very generous to musicians. So they had to, and Monk got a last-minute booking in San Francisco at the Jazz Gallery, or Jazz Workshop, Jazz Gallery, Jazz Workshop. Let's see, my mind is going. I was recommended from two completely different sources.
Independently?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I got the gig, and I flew up to San Francisco, and here I am, this 30-year-old white kid, you know, and I go down to the dressing room. There's no rehearsal, and there's no book, but I love Thelonious. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams thought I would ever play with him. I never thought I would meet him.
You know? This is stuff you were familiar with his work, so you were presumably performing things you knew, or you were going in completely blind.
No, I was real familiar with his, you know, I had transcribed some of his more complicated music, and that was known by people, and I mean, there was, in those days, a lot of people really didn't like Thelonious, and I think probably still there are a lot of people that don't like him, but to me, he was amazing, and he's one of those people, like, when you're 13 and 14, and you have these people who are, they kill you, you know, they kill you, you know. Then when you're 30 and you've got a whole bunch of knowledge of other things, you hear them again and they're not so good. And sometimes you completely reverse your opinions about people. Like, for example, I was mad about Dave Brubeck, you know, and I had transcribed his solo on a song called Take the A-Train. And I was crazy about him. I couldn't stand, I was like, the alto solo was just something to wait for till Dave played again, you know. And now, Dave's playing is not the highest on my list, although I feel that he's one of the finest human beings that ever lived.
Is it just because you can now you can easily see how it's done? As
well,
as
I see it's
Monk.
Just a, you know, whatever it is. But the alto player is one of my favorite players now, Paul Desmond. And that's how it happens. But Thelonious, I started off by loving him. And as time goes on, now I've been listening to him for 64 years. And he just keeps getting better. As I learn more and get more, like I learned about 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, I got into five tuplets, okay? And it, you know, any musicians will know what I'm talking about, you know, triplets, five tuplets. And then realize that his music is full of five tuplets, and they're not, it's not like sort of, they're like real precise. And so, I mean, it's like you go, God, darn, you know, whoa, I mean, so great. And his time, and I mean, his technique is amazing. There is a piano player that I used to play with a lot who was a heavy session player and could read anything. And I got a copy of some transcribed Thelonious Monk stuff with the complete piano part, you know, and I say, here, play this, you know, and he sits down, he looks at it, and he plays very confidently. He plays the first chord, he goes, bong, and then he's like, because everything goes to a different place than ordinarily one goes, you know. He's just really original, but all very, very logical. It's not random. It's very, very logical, you know. It's kind of like, I think of creativity as like a joke. Like a good joke is the punchline is something that's very clearly an outgrowth of the buildup, but not what you expected.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. And that's Thelonious. It's all very, you know, all the voice leading is very, he's just marvelous.
Anyway, I could listen to you talk about this all
day. I forget what we started off here.
I did too. You were on the session for You Lost That Love and Feeling with the Righteous Brothers, is that correct?
That's right.
Wow, what was that like?
You're going to be very disappointed. I did a lot of that thing, what they call the Wrecking Crew. I was a sub.
For the Wrecking Crew?
Yeah.
Really? That's a great documentary.
They didn't call them the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just a bunch of guys, you know. And Phil Spector, who, I mean, he's still alive, so I don't want to say, you know. But, I mean,
they talk about him like he's a genius.
But, anyway, yeah.
Wait a minute. No, I gotta stop you. I want to hear this.
His big wall of sound was four guitars, four keyboards, four drummers, four bass players, four saxophone players. That was his big wall of sound. And so he had four different bass players, a Dano Electric, a Guitarone, Fender bass, and an upright bass. And so whenever any of the people would take off, the upright bass player would take their instrument, and I would get called to play upright bass. So I did a great many of those things, and I was at one point I was in sometimes doing as many as five sessions a week.
Really?
Not just with them, but that whole group of people, and it was real in to me very, very low class music and silly music, you know, bubblegum music. And one day I was in there, and I had about 3 years of that. And then one day I was in there, I think it was a Cher or Sonny and Cher, one of those. And somebody had written an arrangement that was interesting. It had a James Jamerson kind of bass line, like, you know, real interesting bass line. And so they said, can you simplify the bass line? Okay. Can you simplify it a little more, you know? And so, can you simplify it a little more? Bing, 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 bing. That's it. Which is the standard stupid bass line for everything.
Uh-huh.
And I, at that point, I went to myself, you know, this is not why I became a musician. And I walked away from it.
Oh.
you know. And very easy to do because just like acting, it's a hustling business.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's acting at the level of not being a star,
right?
Where they're coming after you, you know. So I just stopped hustling and it was over. And then I had a series of really good work. I worked with Johnny Mathis for a couple of years, and I was Mason Williams' bass player for a long time, and he was the greatest of the greatest of people to play with. He was, as it was all pop music, but and then I began to get more back into jazz, which was my original thing.
Well, Putter, it has been wonderful to talk to you about all of this. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you again very much, Putter Smith, and thank you again very much, Rachel Mays, for putting all of that together. I will post pictures of my soon-to-be sister-in-law, dressed as Putter Smith's character, Mr. Kidd from Diamonds Are Forever, as well as Rob and Kate, on the episode page for this show on earwolf.com. I also want to mention that I actually reached out to Bruce Glover, who plays Mr. Wint in this duo, to come on this podcast as well, and he responded to me, but... Well, he's Crispin Glover's father, so if you know anything about Crispin Glover, you can imagine that Bruce Glover might, how should I put this? Well, he's a little strange. And when I sat down to talk to Putter Smith, I actually sat down with his wife for a little while and had a wonderful conversation, and she was a little more forthcoming maybe than Putter was about their working relationship and how, well, let's just say Putter's a stand-up guy, and she was... telling me how he expressed that he was new to acting when he met Bruce Glover on the set. And Bruce Glover said something to the effect of, basically, I'll handle it. I'll handle your lines. I'll handle everything. And I think Putter was too much of a gentleman to say so. But in my email correspondence with Mr. Glover, let's just say that sounds like it might be in keeping. So if you know Bruce Glover out there, don't tell him about this. There's always someone that seems to want to run and tell people about these things, and he seems like a fairly dangerous guy. I'm not trying to defame him. I'm just trying to get the story straight. For journalism, for cinema history, for mankind. But I also want to take a second to talk about a new book that is out. It's called Come Twilight, and it's written by Tyler Dilts. Now, this is somebody I went to college with. In fact, we acted together. He was Lenny in Of Mice and Men, and I was the bad guy, Curly. If you can believe that. So we'd have a fight where he crushed my hand that I was wearing a glove on that was full of Vaseline to keep soft for my wife. That makes more sense if you've seen the play or read the book. Anyway, this book, it's a great detective series that takes place in and around Long Beach, California. But the best part is the main hero, the detective himself, Danny Beckett, starts listening to podcasts throughout this entire adventure. Most significantly, your podcast truly, I was there too. In fact, I'm very excited to say it even becomes a bit of a like thematic idea throughout the narrative of this book. Is this the first time a podcast has done that? I can definitively guess yes. And the actual theme song lyrics to this podcast are the little lyrical introduction to the first page of this book. Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. So if you're interested in a detective novel about a guy who also listens to many of the same podcasts that you probably do, I highly recommend this. But on top of that, I'm almost done with it. I've got about 20 more pages left. I've found it a really engaging book. I also lived in Long Beach for 20 years, so it's really fun to hear some of the same restaurants and bars that I went to mentioned in this, much less the podcast. For instance, here's a passage from page 211. There were only a few episodes of I Was There Too that I hadn't heard yet. Soon I'd be relegated to new episodes like everybody else. That was my biggest complaint about podcasts. I'd find one I liked, binge listen to all the old episodes, and then when I was completely hooked, I'd be left to the whims of lazy podcasters who somehow think an hour every 2 weeks or so is an acceptable level of output. I take that as a personal dig, Tyler. I thought about fast-forwarding through the theme song so it wouldn't be stuck in my head all night, but then I realized that just thinking about skipping it had already planted the earworm. It's been said you can't handle the truth, but that ain't so. How do I know? I was there too. In bed, trying to sleep, I listened to Dwyer Brown talking about playing Costner's dad in Field of Dreams. Look, if that isn't a recommendation for a book, I don't know what is. You don't need Oprah to tell you that. It's called Come Twilight by Tyler Dilts. This is the real deal, available in all the book places like Amazon.com. All right, that's it for this week. But I do want to tell you, the three episodes we got coming, and if things work out as I expect they will with the 50th episode, not necessarily even a guest, I've got some glory in the pipe for you. Glory in the pipe. Tyler, if you're listening, I'd love that to be the continuation novel to your detective series. If you can connect me with a guest that is perfect for this show, please email me at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter at Matt Gourley and Instagram and Letterboxd. I'm also there as at iwasthere2. Follow and you'll learn more. Until next 2 week, have a good 2 week, everybody. A fortnight, a half month, a 1/26th, a 7 day, a spring break, a really old fly's life.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.